So I'm talking about an interface for corpus-based Tibetan linguistics research, which is kind of ambitious, but that's what we want to do. And I'm just going to describe towards the end of this talk the kind of preliminary directions that we've made on this. So the starting point is the stuff that Nathan and Abel have talked about. We have a robust part of speech tag set and scheme. We have an increasingly substantial set of carefully checked hand tag data. We have an effective rule-based tagger, which was just described. And we have lots of untagged data. So when we started this project, there was no shortage of digital Tibetan materials. And in fact, we've worked really just with stuff that came to us in Unicode, as Unicode. We haven't even converted the stuff that was given to us as Wiley. So from the starting point, there's two questions that we have. One is, how can we facilitate qualitative and perhaps also quantitative linguistics research based on this? So we're all linguists, we're very interested in linguistic research, but not exclusively. And the second question, can this kind of research also improve the quality of our tools? So we're still building the tools. We want to improve the rule-based tagger, we want to improve our statistical tagger and so forth. So can we do research as the project is going along and improve the tools? So those are sort of the two motivating questions. I want to do a little background on the materials, which will recapitulate a little bit and go over some of the terminology that's been explained already with a walkthrough of a few features of our website, which until now has just been a workflow tool. So it's not a pretty thing that we're disseminating to the public. It's just something we're using internally to manage our materials and our workflow process. So we have a bunch of data that we've ingested, and the data has been organized into collections that we call data tags. Basically, data tags might correspond to particular stories. So for example, the Milarepa Namtar is a data tag. It might be a collection of a number of different things together. So for example, the classical corpus, which I'll show searches of a little bit later. And then the Petersburg corpus, which is Pavel's hand-tagged corpus of assorted materials. So these are separated out into different data tags, different collections, so that we can analyze them differently. Really, what that is, what each data tag is a collection of materials to which we apply possibly different sequence of analytical tools. So it may be a different word breaker, maybe a different rule-based tagger, maybe a different statistical tagger, and so forth. And then we look at the results. Okay, so just to take one, the Zhangmun. So we have each of the data tags is evaluated. So in answer to Nathan's question about where we've got, well, he seems to remember perfectly. Our accuracy on this data tag, this set of data, which has 47,000, almost 48,000 hand-tagged words, the accuracy is up to 99.4%. That means the number of words that still have a tag on them, which is correct. So it could be 10 tags on the word, but as long as the right tag is there, then it's accurate. And the ambiguity is down to 1.36, which again means there's an average of 1.36 tags per word. This is after the rule-based tagger has applied. So as Nathan earlier pointed out, it is a substantial improvement from the lexical tagger, which of course is 100% accurate. The third figure there is the correct count. So correct just means how often do we choose the one and only one correct tag? So the tag that the human has chosen. And that you can see is, well, about, you know, in between 2 out of 3, 3 out of 4 times. So pretty good, but there's a lot of work to be done. So quite a number of words we leave ambiguous for the human to come along and say, it's this or it's that. Okay, so that's an example of a data tag. Within each tag, there are quite a number of pages, so all the materials that go into a data tag. Basically, the pages for us correspond, and sorry about the fonts, it's just this computer, I guess. They correspond generally to a page of a Tibetan pecha if it's come in that way, but really what a page is just a piece of data. So if we look at a page, we'll see, for example, the way that the human annotator has tagged the page, has broken it up into words and then tagged each word. There are a couple of other things that are available. The main thing I'll just point to is pre-tagging. So the pre-tagging is what Nathan described earlier as this process of, well, it's applying the lexical tagger and then applying the rule tagger on top of this. So this is when a human comes along and tries to tag a new text, they'll go to the pre-tagging page for a new page that hasn't been annotated, and they copy this out, they paste it out into a spreadsheet or something, and they decide for each of these ambiguous words what it actually is. And then we get that back and we ingest it into the system. Okay. Other things you can do with a data tag, there's the bit about the rule suggestions, which Nathan talked about earlier. There's stuff about downloading bits and pieces for use with our statistical taggers. You can download a lexicon of words just from that data tag. And also you can look at the tags used in that particular subcorpus. So for example, if we want to look at the tags used in the Milarepa Namtar, we see, okay, there's all these tags. We can choose a tag, for instance, the mimetic adverbs, and then you see a list of them here. And then you can click on individual examples, and then it'll pull up all of those examples from the corpus, not many for that particular word. And then you can click through and see the context. Okay, so that's what the data tags are. So, a note briefly on the statistical taggers. So, we started last year, we were actually using statistical taggers more than a statistical tagger in particular, more than the rule based tagger, because we hadn't developed the rules yet. Now, there were a couple of issues, a couple of problems with that. The first was that we had limited training data, of course. So at the beginning of the project, there wasn't as much data as we have now to feed into the statistical tagger, to train it to do better on new data. So of course, that led to the second problem, that we were getting a lot of mistakes. Absolute mistakes. So in fact, our statistical tagger, perhaps in one respect because we hadn't configured or tweaked it properly, was saying, absolutely, it's this, which was totally wrong. So the accuracy was quite low. You know, it was actually deciding in every case what it thought was the best choice. So it wasn't a particularly useful way often for the human tagger to take that output and tag a new text. It just wasn't good enough. But of course, as Nathan has pointed out, in the end game, statistical taggers will play a very important role for us. So what we see is that, and this is increasingly recognized and understood within the computational linguistics community, that you need a combination of statistical and rule-based methods. So we would like to improve the rule-based tagger further so that ambiguity is brought down without sacrificing accuracy, and then we'll apply in some connection to that statistical taggers to lower the ambiguity. So hopefully there will be a happy combination of the two approaches in the end. So I won't say anything further about statistical taggers. Okay, so as far as searching, what have we been able to do? Well, until now, until just a few days ago, really not a whole lot. So, for example, if we look at case, the elative case, we find ne with tick and ne without tick. So you may have noticed this already, that for a lot of these words, there's two examples of every word. There's with the tick, many words with the tick and without it. So we haven't merged these, because of course they have different behavior. So what is the difference? We can click and see, oh, this one without the tick seems to occur before she, punctuation. So okay, that's what's going on there. And the other one with the tick generally occurs before a word. So this is kind of, you know, and we could also type a word in here, but basically that's all we've been able to do, is just search for individual words or drill down by part of speech category to find particular examples. But it hasn't been a useful way to find patterns, and it hasn't really facilitated yet any kind of linguistics research. So let's take a look at some work in progress on a new interface. So now each data tag also is associated in connection with the output of the rule-based tagger to a link called shingles. So I'll click on the shingles link for the classical corpus. Now, what is a shingle? A shingle is otherwise known as what's sometimes called an n-gram, although a shingle is used for collections of words. So basically, it's a collection of adjacent words. And I'm not really sure why it's called shingle. It may be because of the overlapping, like shingles on a house or whatever, that basically you take all the words in the corpus and you select a window, a number of words, and then take every sequence of that number of words and store it as for your, you know, feed that into a statistical model, or just store it so you know how many times I bit the occurs. And you can find all examples of I bit the or I ate the or whatever. So for every single sequence of words. So so we've analyzed our corpus into a bunch of shingles, our tagged corpus. So now we're thinking of how we can explore the corpus as tagged by the rule-based tagger, looking not at the word forms, but at the part of speech tags. So methodologically, we have two different kind of things we can, two different sources of research. One is the human tag data. So we could just say, okay, we want to do some linguistics research. Let's take the data, only the data that we're certain about, only the stuff that we've actually tagged, you know, fair number of words, but not tons of words, and we've already seen that data. So, you know, we probably know what's in it. Maybe we can even remember it. So let's just look at that. We could do that, and that's useful for some purposes. But on the other hand, we might say, no, let's not just look at that. Let's take all this data that's out there and let's unleash our tools on that data and let's study that data. Now, of course, the data that results from that process may be incorrect. We've seen the kind of accuracy and ambiguity levels that we get. But there's certain bits of material there, in fact, a lot of it, that we can draw reasonable conclusions from. So that is, we've decided, a useful approach. And of course, it'll become more and more useful and more effective the more our tools improve in their quality. So for now, what this is there's nothing about the technical infrastructure that requires the shingling to be done on the output of the rule-based tagger, but that's what I'm showing you now. On the output of the rule-based tagger applied to a wider corpus than just what we've hand-tagged, but that's what I'm showing you now. Second caveat, so something to bear in mind, and this is worth noting in particular because when Nathan talked about the accuracy and ambiguity before, and I reiterated it, we skipped over one problematic point, which is that those numbers are based on taking words that we know to be correct words. So we computed those figures and all the numbers that we've shown you on text that has been word broken correctly. So the results are only as good as the word breaker that precedes them. And we know at this point that our word breaker, that our word segmentation tool that we're using is not great. So in fact, when applied to new texts, so when we unleash the rule-based tag, the lexical tagger and the rule-based tagger on new texts, there are a lot of things that, well, first of all, there's a lot of things that maybe are words, but are not in our dictionaries yet. And second of all, there are just mistakes in the word breaking. So actually, you know, for the human tagger encountering this new data, it's not simply a matter of removing the incorrect tags, it's also a matter of moving the word breaks around. So we're aware of this and have just got a slew of articles from China and are working through these and working as a matter of urgency to improve the word breaking, the word segmentation tools that we use, which are sort of a bit of a bottleneck. Okay, so that's a caveat. So what kind of research questions might we be interested in? So we've sort of just begun to think about this, but what can our corpus possibly tell us? Well, one thing we've thought about is, we've got noun phrases. We've got things that go in noun phrases, nouns, determiners, demonstratives, pronouns, adjectives. What is the order of elements within a noun phrase? Maybe we shouldn't come out and say it's this because we think we know the answer. Maybe we should try to use the corpus to tell us. So we can type in a tag and count, and then we will see all examples of n count and where, so n count, this will show n count So right now the shingle size is three words, which means it's a window of three words. And it shows, for example, that punctuation, end count. So examples of a noun starting a sentence. Say, there's lots of examples of that. And examples of nouns linked with a genitive, lots of examples of that. So there's a lot of stuff that, well, these things are maybe not so interesting or relevant to that way of, to the question that we framed. So what else can we do? Well, first of all, we might say, okay, to explore the structure of the noun phrase, actually, we're not interested in the nouns that are at the end of a three-word window. We just want to look at shingles that start with a noun. So with this interface, we can just switch the hit on that button, and then we say, okay, just show me the cases, the shingles that start with a count noun. And then maybe we're starting to get some more relevant results. But there might be things that we're not so happy about. So for example, we see end count v imp. So this is something, this is a case where the rule tagger has not decided. It says this word could be a noun or it could be an imperative verb. And relatedly, the next thing could be case or it could be a converb. So if we're interested in the structure of noun phrases, maybe we don't want to look at that. So there's a filter. Right now it's set to ignore. So ignore the ambiguous tags. Well, we can say, well, for this research question, I'd like to exclude the ambiguous tags. And then hopefully it should have excluded them. And I guess it did. So that's good. Right now it's returning 100 shingles. So it's returning like the top 100 kind of most frequent shingles, but we can change that at a bit of a loss of performance, but still it's pretty good up to 500. So maybe now we might want to kind of narrow the search a little bit, so maybe let's look and see if looking for nouns followed by adjectives tells us anything. And I should say I'm a little bit like the computer that Nathan was speaking about earlier, that sometimes I just get a lot of things in my head and I am not always reasonable. So sometimes I have a training in linguistics, but I have to kind of sometimes back out of the computational mode to try to figure out whether any of this is worth searching for. But I try to hope that it may be. So we could switch around and say, let's look at num. Maybe we want to do, if we add in another tag, then we might want to increase the shingle size to 4. That's actually the biggest that we have at the moment, so we can just look at 4, a sequence of 4 words together. And what do we discover? Well, one thing that I noticed earlier was we have examples of end count, num card, adjective, and we also have examples of encount, adjective, num card. So I don't know what's going on there, but there could be something interesting. And so we can see the possibilities maybe that we could use this to begin to explore examples and narrow down our search in a more useful way than we've been able to up to this point. We might, what else could we do? Oh, we might ask, is it true that there are no examples Nathan mentioned earlier of the future before converb ella, converb ellative? So that could be something we might be able to check. And it seems there are a small number of examples. That's a very small number of examples. So this is so bleeding edge that we can't yet click on the examples and see them. But
soon,
within a few days, that's what we'll be able to do. So then we could say, okay, well, isn't that what we're not supposed to be able to get? Does that mean that there's a mistake with our rules? Or are these counterexamples? Or what's going on?
If you moved it to the right,
okay. I mean, you can change it to four shingles too. Case agentive, temporal, future. I mean, that's all. Oh, no, it's not. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Everything can happen sometimes.
What is the ordering of components? Okay, so another question that we've thought about was, so Abel was talking this morning about, he was talking about the selectional properties of different verbs. And he has the idea that the matrix verbs of infinitive construction strongly select for certain verb stems. So something like the pres. The term and then the. So maybe. So, like, so there's 18 examples of this verb that select for V pres. Is that what you would expect? I can't remember. Yeah, okay. So, actually, maybe I should ignore.
The thing that's tricky about it now is like 18 examples that something does happen doesn't show you that it's, you know, 18 examples of juk with the present doesn't show you that juk can't happen with the past.
Yeah, so.
And then you have to also try with the past.
Yeah.
And then the trouble that I think we're having is like, maybe you'll have one example with the past and 18 with the present, where the numbers aren't different enough to make the conclusion definitive, which is one reason why we're throwing more data into it, so that hopefully those numbers will pull apart.
Right? Yeah, so I mean, we did throw the Otani data in there. So there's more data than there was even a few days ago. But the idea of this particular investigation would be that if we look at these specific verbs, if we can find, say, that particular verbs are always selecting the past or always selecting the pres, then we could show that in those cases where, I think I may have to pull up a so V fut, yeah. V pres.
Is this the version I think of as verbal nouns or not?
You have to type in NV.
Okay.
So then the point of this is that, okay, if we look for that same verb, then with the v pres, well, if that's a verb that always selects for v pres and never selects for v fute before cv term, then the v fute v pres must be a v pres. So it helps to allow us to make that decision that we were unable to make on the basis of the form alone. That we were unwilling to make on the basis of the form alone. And then, you know, there's a lot of...
Why sometimes you get the verb stem and sometimes you don't? Is that below a certain hits that you get the verb stem?
Why is the Tibetan displaying?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit...
can you see ze and you can't see, like, 53? Because it's below 10 you get the specific...
Well, it's probably because the 53 includes more...
53 is all of the V pasts.
Yeah, so below a certain number of hits you get the...
No, the thing is that the 53 includes many verbs.
And then you have, so this would be, the 53 would include the one with Z, the one
exactly.
With Z.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So, and, I mean, there's a little sort of weirdness.
Or you can also look for directly the verb stem if you
but
want.
But let's say,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's some...
So, okay, for instance, if you select only new.
Yeah, that's the other thing you can do. You can just pick a verb you're interested in and look at what happens to its left, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
it'd be harder now because we might have trouble inputting Tibetan. Right?
500. And then in this case, if we type in the verb stem, we're going to get the nominalized forms as well, which is nice.
Yeah, that's nice. Mm-hmm.
So we can look at all the, maybe... the top 500 things, sets of three things that occur before that lemma. Actually, in this case, because we're searching in the middle, search both sides, we're allowing the lemma to be in the middle. So the stuff could be on the left. You have two things on the left and one on the right, or and so on. And we also have the right and left searching. Okay, so that gives you an idea of the kind of direction that we're going with the searching and the kinds of questions that we hope that maybe we might be able to answer using data that's not been human tagged, but we've run our tools over. There was a third one. Oh, well, we had the idea that the allative converb might be used to conjoin imperatives. Well, it is used to conjoin imperatives. But it turns out that we don't have any examples. Looks like, there's maybe a couple, like these two, these could be examples of an imperative verb conjoined by an allative, we're not sure. So, of course, even with a corpus that's getting larger and larger, certain things don't happen very often, so there are limits to how useful searching can be based on part of speech tags. Okay, so one thing that this all goes towards the first question that I asked, which was how can we begin to facilitate and qualitative and perhaps quantitative linguistics research based on such a corpus. So I mentioned one limitation that will be addressed very quickly, which is that you're supposed to be able to click on this here and then go off to the two examples and see them and somehow come back sort of easily to this, so they should be more or less seamless. The second thing that you might like to do is, so this kind of interface is nice if you're just sort of exploring. So I don't really care about doing serious statistics or whatever. I'm just kind of, that's why I keep saying qualitative, because I'm using it to find examples and maybe to rule out certain things, but it's a little bit informal. But we also might like to kind of do something a little bit more robust, like export all examples, you know, export all shingles that have VIMP followed by CV all, and then export it into a spreadsheet and kind of sort and rearrange things and follow up on the links separately. So those two things are a few of the important things that we look to do quite soon. The second question that I asked was, can research driven by an interface like this and where it goes, can it help to facilitate or improve the quality of our tools? So I think the answer is yes, and one of the thoughts here is that's partly what this ambiguous tags filter is doing. So I'll change the shingle size to 200 shingles, and I think for some reason it doesn't update. But let's say 200, the top 200 shingles involving V, so involving a verb. And if we change ignore to require, so we say we don't want to ignore the ambiguous tags, but we want you to only show us things that have some ambiguity, then that potentially becomes quite a useful way to find things that, basically to sort of pick out the low-hanging fruit. Stuff that, if we correct, you know, maybe we see, there's 347 cases of VIMP or V invariant before punctuation. Well, that's probably a difficult one. But, a lot of the ones that are going to show up high are going to be the difficult ones, but it'll give us something to kind of focus on. So three word shingle sizes require ambiguity. Well, the ambiguity is already coming from case term versus CV term. But for example, we don't, you know, case and converbs basically almost always have two identical forms. So the case is following something nominal and the converb is following something verbal. Well, could we look through this and maybe find some ideas for new rules that we could construct that might reduce the ambiguity by ruling out certain interpretations? So that's the idea of that filter. So when you're only interested in so if you're only interested in researching stuff that's certain, then okay, we focus on excluding the ambiguous tags and we run the tools across the entire corpus and we say, okay, tell me what you really know. I want to look at that. When we want to look at the stuff that is unsettled, and then we can do that filter, and hopefully this will improve our tools. So as I say, this is, you know, in progress and will be used. We're going to start to use it and hopefully find ways to improve it, and your feedback would also be quite welcome. And there is also, finally, I'd mention a similar interface that we could build just for searching the Tibetan words. So use the same idea of shingles to find frequent combinations of Tibetan words, but we haven't put that on online. We're not showing that at the moment because we've been focusing on the kinds of questions that we can answer using the part of speech tags. Okay, any questions or comments?
Well, how do you limit the corpus in which it's searching? Is there a way of saying, I only want to look in everything I have, only in one text? Or
yeah, so that one was the classical corpus.
So I did classical corpus shingles.
Okay.
So if I want to just do the Milarepa Namtar, I just search
from
there.
Do you want to look to all of it? Can you do that? Or?
Well, basically, depends all on the classical.
Yeah, I mean, all of it is pretty much the classical corpus. The Petersburg corpus uses a different tag set, so we haven't included that yet because it would kind of throw off the rest of our data, and we're kind of trying to migrate that over. But as for the rest, it's all in the classical corpus. So really, there's one data tag to explore everything, and then there's individual data tags for the subparts if you just want to look at those.
What happens when you have, say, in Milarepa, you have poetry?
Could you be more specific?
Well, the grammar can change.
We could... If we think it's important, we can always make a separate collection for any subset.
The trouble is we don't have an automatic tool. You could imagine making one, but we don't have an automatic tool to detect poetry.
Right.
And actually, it's fairly straightforward how you could imagine doing that, but that hasn't seemed like a high priority because of the other things we're doing. And then the other things, it would introduce problems because for instance, these counts that he's giving, those aren't counts of the number of times that construction happens in the corpus. Those are counts of how many distinct pecha folios, or how many different pecha pages that construction happens on. So it's actually vastly undercounting extremely common phenomena. It's getting rare phenomena right, yeah? But that's because the sort of in terms of, if you like, the ontology of our system, the folio page is what it's all based on. So I think one thing we should think about in the future is whether we should chop things smaller than that or differently than that. But the nice thing about a folio page is, of course, it has a real existence in the real world, whereas if we did, like, sentences, what is a sentence, and how many sentences does the Milarepa Namtar have? And if I tell you, this happens in sentence 963 in the Milarepa Namtar, that's not very helpful, right? So we've built everything on the pecha page, but that does have certain sort of methodological drawbacks, like the... potentially flagging poetry is harder to do if a poem, goes on both sides of a patron page. It doesn't interact well with the conceptualization of Tibetan as a collection of pages.
One thing we can do actually is, when we link from the results to the individual, to the results page, it can, on that page, display the correct count. So the difficulty is not counting the words so much as counting the occurrences, as it is sort of tabulating the occurrences of all the words. So if we know which word we want to count, then it's very easy to count. So basically we're using these numbers as sort of heuristics about frequency. So 81 means at least 81, and then we'd click through to that and it would say, 160 or something, or 200.
You could actually just determine poetry from counting sentences if you've got two lines.
Yeah, but you don't want to say, like, if you have two, let's say, inter-shay segments that both have seven syllables, that's necessarily verse, right? Sometimes you'll just have two things next to each other.
It would be a coincidence.
Yeah.
But it means that you could extract poetry as well, if you have.
Yeah, you could remove it, whatnot. But that would, basically what I was saying is, currently we don't have any way of looking at smaller units than the page to page.
Right.
And so if we did that, it may be worthwhile, but it would involve a whole new level of complexity.
But if we knew, because for each
page, we can at least go through and go to the page like I showed you before, and that page, so we go to a page, and then, you know, as and there's a little bit of metadata about the page. So if it so happened that we could classify entire pages as, like, you know, this is definitely poetry and this is definitely not poetry, then we could use machine learning techniques to classify pages as to whether or not, you know, they are or they have poetry or not. It wouldn't tell us, like, at the sentence or verse level or whatever, but that would be something that,
yeah, we might be able,
you know,
to,
we could do like classifying whole texts and stuff, and it might yield useful results with existing
so
tools.
From beginning of page to end of page, sorry, beginning of page to end of page.
Yeah, in general,
rather from share to share.
Yeah, yeah. In general, each page is a page. Yeah.
Right.
And then the only exception is if a word spills over onto the next page,
yeah,
then we push it onto the previous page, because it's not very useful to have, you know, little half words floating around. Yeah. So that's what we do is we follow the pitch of page, and that's the minimal unit that our sort of system stores. Well, that's not quite accurate, but you know what I mean. But then the one thing the human being will do is if there's something like gal po, is gal is on one page and po is on another page. Well, you don't want that po floating around.
Mm-hmm.
So you just move it onto the previous page. And that's a kind of, you know, intellectual error in a way. You might instead want to keep track of the fact that that poem is on the next page. But that would, again, be a very difficult sort of technical problem that I think would have little return on the investment. And one thing just to keep in mind about all this is we're not editing text here, right? These are, if you want to know where, what word a page of page begins with or ends with, or if you want to read the Miller Epinator, don't look here, for God's sake. You know, there are text editions and pages for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is developed for certain purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder why you haven't gone from share to share rather than from page.
Oh, because then it would be very hard to, like I was saying, like how would you keep track of them? You would just number the shays in the Miller-Epinator and then say, like, at Shay 623, there's a really interesting negated verb form. That's much less easy for human beings to deal with. Right?
Yes, but you then have the Shay 623 is on page whatever. Which,
yeah,
but
then
human can. But then you've at the moment you are, in a sense, editing the text because you're moving your pole.
Oh yeah.
Onto,
yeah,
the,
yeah. But the thing, well, we're assuming that someone,
that's just the physical limitations. Page, it's not anything particularly to do with the language, actually.
Oh, of course, yeah. We've been trying to keep things, the basic thing is, we've been trying to keep things extremely flat. And I mean that in a sort of technical sense, which is, like, I was involved in a project in Tubium once where we tag sentences, and within the sentences we tag noun phrases, and we tag what was poetry and what wasn't poetry, and which verbs governed which nouns, and had this gorgeous architecture that was extremely deep, yeah? And in a 6-year project, we got through about 12 pages.
Oh.
So maybe to some extent, as an overreaction in the other direction, I have said, we have to keep it totally flat. So doing something like keeping track of words that cross over pages, or poetry versus prose, would require two tiers of analysis, where you have, here are the pages running along, and here are the sentences running along. Sometimes they line up, and sometimes they don't line up. And so I sort of, from the beginning, I said, no, we can't do it. We have to stay totally flat. And then once we get good at the things that we're aiming to get good at, future research can try and add that.
You could use this to achieve that.
Exactly.
Also, a couple other remarks on that. Like, the end product is not necessarily these pages given to people and say, like, we don't give them this page and say, here's page such and such of the Miller-Epinator. What we would do is probably line that up with your page, something like that, or apply the tool to your data.
Yeah.
And then another thing, the data has come to us like that, so we've just ingested it.
Right.
And then the third thing is that it's just been useful to take the page, to have pages as chunks, because for our statistical evaluation, we've assigned every page a kind of identifier, and then we group the text into 8 different chunks. So we need some like way to break the entire corpus into pieces. Mm. So the page is just a convenient mechanism to do that. And then, you know, 1/8 of that stuff we train the statistical tagger on 7/8 of it, and then test on the 1/8, and then do the same with all the other bits. So it kind of fits into the...
Didn't the Virginia Congreve come with line?
Came with both lines on pages.
Yeah. So that's really what you will aim for? Or, because it's quite useful if you search stuff on the Econgreve, you obviously get the term, you get the line and the page.
Yeah, I think we threw that out intentionally in order to keep things flat again, right? Because this problem of like Galpo crossing paid would become, let's say, at least 4 times more frequent if you included line numbers.
Yeah. And because the other collections haven't done it, you would have then to retake.
Yeah, exactly.
The non-Congreve material, which is not something you wanted to do because you had other.
Yeah, and so I think the way, like Ed said, the way to think about it is of these 3 products we're producing, the corpus, and the two software tools are the more important ones. Because if we have these 2 software tools extremely good, and you want to have the conjure with line numbers, well, just take the conjure with line numbers, it's already there, and then apply these tools. Yeah.
So we'll just have to worry a little bit maybe about the matching at the later stage when we're matching up somebody else's version with our version, and maybe little corrections or changes if we'd made them or whatever, that could become an issue.
Can I just ask about possibilities? Is this the right time to
maybe? Yeah, sure.
Is that a few years ago somebody made a bit of a splash in the papers about comparing through with English anyway, and determining whether through this kind of analysis, I think, whether somebody had written something. You can say, like Shakespeare, 97% sure that this is written by him. And I just thought, you know, with Wiley, you could almost achieve that with Tibetan as well. You could actually almost determine who had written, or was likely to have written. It was the same person who had written something.
Yeah,
do you think that can be achieved with this?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. I've been trying just early this week. I found one way of construction in Conjure, where I thought, oh, that's funny, I have to look for more examples of that.
Yeah.
And then there was only like a few specific texts, and thought, oh, that's funny, because the situation where the construction can occur is not that rare, so there must be a specific reason why it is it. And then you look up the translators, and you see the same translators involved, or something like that, or the same editor.
Yeah.
And say, if you have, this is one criterion, right, I'm looking for. But say if you have 5 criteria like that, who say yes or no, right?
Yeah.
Then you can distinguish 32 different styles.
Yeah.
And that adds up pretty quickly. So yeah, you can do a lot.
Yeah.
It's been really remarkable to me, actually. So I primarily worked on the Zongun and the Milarepa, which are both used very early in pedagogy, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are hardly in the same language. Yeah, it's really radically different, and so there are for instance, a number of converbs that are basically gone in the Milarepa-Navatara, and new ones that occur in the Milarepa-Navatara. So I do think that, I mean, there you're dealing with a gap of 600 years or something like that, totally different parts of Tibet. But we're trying to make the software so that it can more or less chew through all styles and all periods. And then the question of how these styles and periods differ from each other can be investigated after they've been chewed through. For instance, you could just come up with frequency lists of, and then find this author uses this term and this author doesn't, or things like that, yeah?
No, but there is a problem with that, I mean, at least the Milarepa-Navatara is a basically a composite text that takes bits and pieces from. It's very stratified.
Yeah, what text is this?
No, but I mean, and also if you use one edition of the text that's edited over time, right?
Yeah.
And they also change the vocabulary. They might change in terms of new standard language standards. So they sort of standardize what they find. So if you apply it, and then it depends on what copy of the text you have.
That's not right.
Well, it is.
But no, the
how do you know it has been edited or changed?
Because I have two copies of the same text. One was printed, so carved on one date, and one was carved 200 years later.
So you know what? The point is, I'm just actually telling you, you're sort of self-assertive because you actually made a decision on the basis of data in the text. So that's what you can do.
Right? Yeah, but I mean, if you want to, I'm just saying that if you look for some recurrent things in text, you're looking, so you're not looking for the meter ever on top, but you're looking for a certain copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
So your data, in this case, like, oh, I want to see if this text has been written by this person at this time, because I want to know, I want to look if this fact that I know happens at some point in the language occurs in there. So, but the best that you can say is that it happens or it doesn't happen in the copy that you have digitalized and you have analyzed, but not the moment when it was translated or written or...
Yeah, I think that's important.
I mean?
Yeah, but that those problems exist whether or not you can use these sorts of tools, right?
Yeah, no, it was just a question to the question of how far can we go with this in terms of distinguishing styles of the or identifying authors. I mean, that's a completely another question.
No, but we can do all of that by investigating exactly the questions you're proposing. Mm-hmm. If we have 12 different versions of the Miller-Epp number, tag them all.
Exactly.
To test how different they are.
When the tagger is sophisticated enough to produce good results, then you can just shoot it through.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the idea. And then, you know, you can develop a hypothesis, for instance, by as a starting place, I'll take all of the works of Zhang Yong, I don't care which edition, some modern edition, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then develop a hypothesis, Zhang Yong likes these constructions or this vocabulary. But now you're right, that's a rash conclusion. In fact, maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe you've gotten it all from the same modern publishing house.
Mm-hmm.
But then those questions can also be empirically investigated.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm
trying to ask.
Yeah.
One more question. About the website. All the three products you are envisioning to have in the end, ready products, they should be available through some web page or website. So is it the same web page which will be the result? And will the interface be like it is today?
Well, probably.
Or the website will be different and.
It's probably going to be a bit more user friendly, you know?
Yeah, we'll have some picture of the Patala in the corner.
The corner. No, but it's true, the way it is presented at the moment,
well,
it's not very user friendly, is it?
I mean, somebody asking about the software that would be available
from something like GitHub,
mm-hmm.
which is just a site that people use to post open source software.
And the corpus.
The corpus. I mean, I think we have to make a decision about about that. I'm not really sure.
This website is only for the working on the corpus, not the place where it will be.
Yes.
Yeah. I think what we'll do is kind of in the last 2-3 months of the project, mm-hmm. we'll say, now we need to make some kind of pretty homepage that's as user friendly as possible. Although one thing we are interested from you in is, I mean, I don't know how easy it is to do, but it's hard for us maybe to know what a user friendly interface would be, because we're quite in the thick of it. So if there is, for instance, a question that you would want to do, or you want to search some text or something, it might be useful to sort of to try things out on some people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know that you plan to use Sketch Engine. You have a license for...
Our license expired, in fact.
So, because Sketch Engine is an interface, it has a ready interface, the only drawback is that you have to pay for the license.
Yeah.
But they can also publish what is produced and it will be open to everyone. So do you have any plans?
We're going to give everything to them. Uh-huh. Yeah, because our basic attitude actually is, you know, this is the taxpayer, poor British taxpayer who's paid for this. And, you know, they could have been building HS2 with it or something like that. So so we will give it away to anyone ever, you know, I'll just walk around who wants a Tibetan corpus. And
okay.
Yeah, and so if even a company like Sketch Engine wants to incorporate it into a product that they, you know, to extract commercial benefit from it, that's wonderful, then we're contributing to the British economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I've already talked to Adam, and we will give them our whole corpus, and then of course they have this extremely sophisticated interface for lexicography and corpus linguistics research, and there's no need for us to develop that. Yeah, they can then just run that automatically on top of our corpus.
And I suppose the worst case scenario is that there's the software that you can download from, you know, an open source site like GitHub, and there's a big file, which is the corpus, and you can download the corpus or get a Sketch Engine subscription and look at it in the Sketch Engine. Hopefully we'll make a prettier interface.
Yeah, but I think in the long term, you know, you won't necessarily be interested in the texts we put in our corpus.
Yeah.
And so the thing that's really necessary is that other people, when they design their own research projects, say, well, I'm interested in these texts, I'm planning on digitizing them anyhow, we might as well run them through the software, or even better, we might as well allocate someone to hand tag a certain amount of the text that I'm working on, so that the accuracy can continue to improve. That's my pitch, if you like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the more it reads and the more genres, the better it will get at all sorts of things. So, like, for instance, you may run it on a 17th century Terma and say, that's a mess, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then don't just tell me, you know, Nathan, this your software works terribly on 18th century Terma. Instead, you know, help me to make it work better on 18th century Terma.
I think having a long period in which we're sort of, you know, turned into users and do experiments and then feed back to you and then, you know, you help to make it more useful or approachable
for
us,
exactly.
And so on.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be very important.
Yeah. But I say a fear I have, especially because in my own personal circumstance, I'm going to become involved in another research project for the next 6 years, is that this will die as soon as we stop working on it, whereas actually it has an enormous amount of potential. So I'm hoping that actually partly from this event you will feel excited enough about the potential of something like this contributing to your own work that you'll help us through that period where this goes from a kind of pilot project at SOAS to being something that's just totally taken for granted in the methodology of Tibetan studies is you know the future that I hope for. And maybe in along those lines I mentioned just the obvious pedagogical advantages. For instance, you could decide which texts you're interested in, your students being able to read, and then get a printout of the most common words in those texts, and then teach your students the most common words first to, you know, better use their time. Or you could, you know, export a dictionary of all the words in a particular text in order to make a sort of glossary of all the words for that particular text,
mm-hmm.
so that your students can, you know, read the Milarepa-Namtar and only have to look up words that you already know in the Milarepa-Namtar, something like this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of research possibilities, but also a lot of pedagogical possibilities for philologists, you know, in Tibetan studies. Of course, these things like screen readers and auto-completion and whatnot will also be wonderful, and we hope software companies pick them up, but you know, you're our first sort of customers. and if we don't make something useful to you, then we won't have made something useful.
And we plan to continue to explore. We're thinking of putting a follow-up application funding to perhaps work on some examples how this can actually be useful.
Well, and there's some obvious things that would add enormous utility. For instance, we've spent a lot of time talking about verbs, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But one thing we haven't done at all is, for instance, you take a verb like to kill, se, 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 se. It has no idea those are the same word.
No.
Yeah? So it would be nice to say, give me all examples, no matter what the tense, of the verb kill. But that requires another level on top of it. And actually isn't that hard a problem, but it's not something we promised the government, so it's not something we're working on. Well, shall we call it a day? Yeah?
Thank you very much.